Okay, good morning, everybody. This is IO 231, and it is April 2nd. And I forgot to tell my lab class this, but it's too late for you to play any practical jokes on me because it's the 2nd already, right? You can only do that on the 1st. Okay, so April 2nd, we're going to finish up peripheral nervous system very quickly. We've got just a couple things to talk about. And then move into autonomic nervous system. And you guys should be really excited about the autonomic nervous system because why? Why should you be really excited about it? Because it controls most things in your body, right? So that's why you should be really interested in the autonomic nervous system. Somatic nervous system only controls skeletal muscle. That's the only thing you have voluntary control of. Everything is controlled. Everything else is controlled by the autonomic nervous system or by the endocrine system, which we're going to get into really quick. All right, so let's look at the schedule to see where we are. April 2nd. Ooh, we're about a lecture behind. I don't know what I'm going to do about that. Maybe I'll put a video lecture in Blackboard for you, or maybe I'll just talk really fast. I'm not sure what's going to happen. All right, so the chapter we're going to cover today is chapter 15, and next week, we do not have any lab practicums, right? So those are going to be postponed until the week after spring break. So let's see, how many weeks do we have before spring break? Only one, right? So we got today's lecture, and then we got a lecture on Monday and Wednesday of next week, and then a break. But during break, hopefully you have a lot of time to study because the Monday right after spring break is the third lecture exam, covering chapters 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. So we got to get through endocrine system at least by the end of next week. So I'm sure we can do that without any problem. But nonetheless, print out all of the study guides for these chapters and start to look at those. At least understand what the scope of the studying you have to do to get prepared for that test. You don't have to start studying endocrine system right now unless you're getting ahead of schedule a little bit, that's okay, but at least print out the endocrine system to see how much material is there. And endocrine system, I believe you don't have any weekly assignments for, but it is in the study guide. Okay, so the Monday class or the Monday labs have a lecture exam and a practicum right after spring break. Okay, and then the Wednesday lab has just a regular lecture on Wednesday and a practicum of that week. Any questions on the schedule? We're good. What about announcements from SI? We're good? Just the usual schedule right there that's on the board? You got it on the board? Okay, so you guys can copy it down when you want to. Okay, that sounds good. So any questions on peripheral nervous system? Do you know the difference between a cranial nerve and a spinal nerve? Okay. Are they both part of the peripheral nervous system, or is one central nervous system and the other peripheral nervous system? One is central and one is peripheral? Aha, I tricked you. They are both peripheral nervous system. It's just that cranial nerves originate from the brain. But they leave the brain, and as soon as they leave the brain, what nervous system do they belong to? Peripheral nervous system. Remember, only brain and spinal cord are part of the central nervous system. As soon as something leaves, then it's no longer part of the brain. It's got to be peripheral nervous system. Okay? All right, so that was kind of a tricky question. Okay, so we learned something about roots and nerves and rami last time. Which ones are mixed in terms of function? Which ones are mixed? Nerves, roots, or rami? Rami are. That's correct, but not completely correct, because so are spinal nerves. Nerves are mixed as well. Right? What about the function of the ventral root? Ventral root.
Motor.
That's right. 100% motor, or are there some afferents in there?
No. 100%.
100% motor, and the dorsal root is 100% sensory. That's right. They're not mixed. So roots are not mixed, but spinal nerves and rami are. Okay. We were talking about some plexis last time, and what is your understanding? What's the purpose of a plexus? What's the beauty of having a plexus or a number of plexis in our body? Let's see if I can find peripheral nervous system. Maybe I can find a picture of a plexus right here. Here's a picture of a plexus. Should remind you of what? A network. Okay, and so what's the beauty of a plexus? Yeah, important signals can get to vital organs via a number of different pathways. So if one of those pathways gets damaged, that vital organ still has innervation. It still can be controlled. Basically, that's it. The other thing is, if there is damage to a plexus, right, you can recover from that much more easily by retraining different pathways to that vital organ. It might take a while, it might take a year, it might take a little bit longer, but eventually with therapy and working with it, okay, you can reestablish good control. So a plexus can sustain a lot of damage, but nonetheless you still can recover from it. So that is something that's really nice about a plexus. And how many plexes am I going to ask you to know about? Okay, cervical, and then brachial, and then lumbar, and then sacral. And you should know some nerves, right, that originate from each of those plexes. And what are some of those nerves? Well, you got two. Phrenic nerve comes from the cervical plexus, C3, 4, and 5. Why is that easy to remember?
Keep you alive.
Yeah, C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive because these things participate to make the phrenic nerve. And where does the phrenic nerve go? It's in your neck, and then it goes all the way to the diaphragm, right? Remember, diaphragm is a skeletal muscle. It's under your voluntary control. It doesn't contract on its own without innervation from C3 or C4 or C5 or all three. Then, of course, you're going to suffocate, and that will happen relatively quickly. Sciatic. Have you ever heard of a sciatic nerve before? Yeah, a lot of people have problems with impingements on the sciatic nerve, and it originates from L4, 5, and S1, and S2. Okay, and what does that S stand for? Sacrum, yeah, sacrum. Okay, so that's part the lumbar plexus and part sacral plexus. Okay, so here are those four plexes. And then lastly, this is the last thing we're going to talk about. What is a dermatome? A dermatome sort of reminds me of that little homunculus man that we looked at. Okay, where did we visualize that homunculus? It wasn't in the peripheral nervous system, it was central nervous system. Right? If we look at the precentral gyrus or the postcentral gyrus, it's arranged by surface area on a person's body. Right? So all of the places that are associated with the head are in one location. Right next to it are areas of the neck, right, and then tongue, and then areas of the thorax. All the hand areas are located next to each other. So you could draw out the surface of somebody's body according to those areas on that precentral or postcentral gyrus. Okay. So the other thing you should know, going back to central nervous system, is what's the function of the precentral gyrus? Just generally speaking, precentral is motor, postcentral is sensation. That's right. So if we stimulate some part of the precentral gyrus, what's going to happen? Are you going to feel something, or is some part of your body going to move? Yeah, because it's motor. If we stimulate some part of the postcentral gyrus, what's going to be the experience? Motion or sensation? Yeah, sensation. Right. So it's really important that you know that. All right. So a dermatome is sort of like that, but kind of on the opposite end. Instead of looking at the central nervous system, for instance, like the postcentral gyrus, this is a map of what spinal nerves go to which regions on the surface of your body. So it's a map of the surface of your body, right, with lines on it telling us what spinal nerves go where. And it's not just an easy pattern to recognize. All right, so these are what we call dermatomes. Oh, I'm already here. All right, so I'm going to have to go forward to find it. Dermatomes. Passed it right here. Okay, so here's a dermatome. You see the silhouette of a person's body, and I see a number of, these things just look like lamellae right here, transverse sections. So this section right here is innervated by spinal nerves that exit T7. Right? And T8, T9, T10, these are pretty easy to identify. But look what happens when we get into the arms. Here is a dermatome from T1, right? And it goes all the way down onto the anterior and actually forms a little point right here, anterior side of the arm. So if we take a pin or something and we stick somebody in this area right on their elbow and they don't feel it, we know what damage is occurring or where that damage is occurring, one of the possible locations. And where is that? Right at T1, where the spinal nerve leaves the vertebral column, right at T1. So we can do a nice imaging study of this area, a nice high-resolution imaging study, and maybe find some structural anomalies in this area. Right, so we don't have to investigate the whole vertebral column. Right, and then here is C5 that also participates in the arm, and C6. And the same thing for the leg. And so there are some kind of not so straightforward dermatomes, but this tells us possibly where there might be a slipped disc or impingement on a spinal nerve as it's exiting the intervertebral foramen. Right. And that's why I mentioned at one point in time that when somebody has problems dorsiflexing, okay, what happens to their foot if they can't dorsiflex? Their toes are going to drag along the ground if they can't dorsiflex. And the tips of their shoes get worn down, and a lot of times physicians just kind of look at the tips of your shoes to see if the tips of your shoes are worn down, especially if you're elderly. And I said it was an indication of vertebral column or spinal nerve damage, even something way down on your toe. Why is that? Yeah. And at what level would that be? On this diagram, you can tell. Where would you want to start looking? Well, here is, right, here's your big toe. Then we'd start looking at L4, maybe L5, and that would be it. So there's damage to these nerves leaving the spinal column at L4 or L5. All right, so if you know these dermatomes, you can kind of jump right to understanding what's happening with that anatomy, what could possibly be wrong with that anatomy. That's nice. So if somebody's having trouble dorsiflexing, would we be interested in looking at any sacral nerves? Because your toes are way down, right, as the most inferior part of your body. Should we start looking in the sacral region? No, because sacral nerves don't innervate the foot. Right? They only innervate things like in the pelvic cavity and inguinal region. Okay. Oh, maybe it's a little bit of a lateral ankle right here. Okay, that would be about it. So these dermatomes are really handy. You might see these in your doctor's office. All right, and so now you kind of have a sense of what these things are, right? Okay. And it's the same for motor. Motor and sensory kind of obey these same kinds of dermatomes. And that's why when somebody has sciatica, where can they feel? Where can they feel some discomfort? Sciatica happens in your hip. Right, impingement of the sciatic nerve, but where can a patient feel some of that discomfort? In their legs, right, and even in their feet, because those nerves, right, originate from, right, the lumbar plexus. Okay. All right, so that's a dermatome. Anybody have a question on dermatome? No. Interesting to look at. All right, so I'm going to put these things away, and we're going to get into what you've been waiting for, autonomic nervous system. And that is right here, autonomic nervous system. You might want to look way back at that introductory chapter of the nervous system where I had a diagram of all the different branches, subdivisions of the nervous system, starting with what? Central, peripheral. Central was broken down into brain and spinal cord. And then as far as peripheral, that could be broken down to sensory and motor. Then we kind of just stayed with motor. Motor can be broken down into... What can motor nervous system be broken down into? What are the components? Somatic and autonomic, right? All right, so now we've fallen all the way down to autonomic nervous system. And how many divisions can the autonomic nervous system be broken down into according to that diagram?
Two.
Yeah, there are two. And what are those two?
Sympathetic.
Yeah, I like sympathetic and parasympathetic. Okay, so here's a diagram which kind of just shows that from in your textbook, but I like my diagram better, so we just talked about the whole slide already. All right, so autonomic nervous system has two divisions, and you should think of these two divisions as being very similar to a biceps brachii and triceps brachii in terms of the musculoskeletal system. All right, so why would that be? Why am I talking about a couple muscles and how similar those two muscles are compared to the autonomic nervous system? What's the link that I'm thinking about? I'm thinking about antagonism, right? So the biceps causes flexion of the forearm, triceps, extension of the forearm, and when these two things are working in combination, you have precise control and balance of where your fingers are going, where your hand is going, where your wrist is going, precise control and balance, right, through those two antagonistic muscles. So you shouldn't be too surprised that the autonomic nervous system that controls most things in your body has antagonism built into it as well for precise control of your heart, right, for your digestive processes, for your vision, all kinds of different things. All right, so that's why we want to have a lot of fun with the autonomic nervous system. All right, so the autonomic nervous system controls involuntary things in your body. There's self-governing systems, for instance, like blood pressure, heart rate, digestion, respiration, urination, sweating. Well, this list is really huge, right? So I probably don't even want to think of all the things that can be involved right here. All right, and so the autonomic nervous system can affect all these things by controlling what kind of effector organs? Yeah, visceral. And I want some specific examples of visceral effector organs. I like smooth muscle. I like cardiac muscle and glands. And I like skeletal muscle. No, I don't like skeletal muscle. Okay, just checking to see if anybody is awake. Everything except skeletal muscle. All right, so cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands. We call these effectors. And what does an effector always produce? It produces a response, right, when it's controlled by the autonomic nervous system, right? Okay. So let's look at this slide right here. It looks a little bit complicated, but we're going to look at it and break it down. I see two main rows, all right? Maybe it's nicely color-coded and it stands out for you very nicely. Here is this first row right here is a main row all by itself. And this represents some structures that we see in the somatic nervous system. What's the effector organ in somatic nervous system? Skeletal muscle. So here's some skeletal muscle. And of course, it's under voluntary control. Do I see that anywhere in here? I don't see it anywhere here. So if you have a slide of this, say, voluntary control, right? Somatic nervous system, voluntary control. The next big row has two components to it. Ooh, you should be kind of already flashing back to what we talked about, has two rows, right? And this represents the autonomic nervous system. And the autonomic nervous system has two sub-rows because why? There are two kinds, there are two parts to that nervous system. There is sympathetic and parasympathetic. All right, so that's how we're going to compare and contrast these things. All right, so the somatic nervous system, if we look at the central nervous system part of it, all right, I see a nerve cell body and some dendrites, and since this is a motor outflow pathway, right, I see the axon leaving the central nervous system, and where does it go then? When it leaves the central nervous system, where does it go? Into the peripheral nervous system, right? So it's still nervous tissue. If it leaves the CNS, the only other place it can go is peripheral nervous system. So nerve cell bodies and dendrites are in the central nervous system, leaves maybe a cranial nerve or spinal nerve to get into the peripheral nervous system. And I see an axon. Is this axon transmitting impulses fast or slow? Fast. How did you know that? Because it's myelinated. That's good. Okay, I'm glad I asked. All right, heavily myelinated axon, it's fast. When a nerve impulse reaches the axon terminus, there is a synapse. And what kind of synapse is this? Is this a chemical or an electrical synapse?
Chemical,
because what is it releasing? The axon terminus is releasing a neurotransmitter. And here you can see the specific name, and that is acetylcholine. All right, so the synapse here is what we call the neuromuscular junction, and all neuromuscular junctions respond to acetylcholine. Right, when acetylcholine is released in the neuromuscular junction, what happens to this biceps right here?
Muscle contracts.
Muscle can't do anything else. Can't make up its own mind to do anything else. It gets that signal, acetylcholine. The only thing it can do is contract. All right, because you're telling that muscle to contract with your voluntary thought. The skeletal muscle can't say, no, I don't want to contract, or I want to contract a little bit, or not at all, or maybe tomorrow I'm going to contract, right? Skeletal muscle doesn't have that ability to do that if it is healthy. So what is the effect of a stimulation from the somatic nervous system on skeletal muscle? It is excitatory, right? It's always going to cause contraction. Yeah, it can never inhibit skeletal muscle. All right, so that's somatic motor outflow pathway. So let's look at the autonomic. Oh, no, there's one last thing I wanted to say. So from the central nervous system to the effector organ, which is skeletal muscle, how many neurons does it take to get there? From CNS to effector organ, how many neurons? I see one. I see one cell body, one axon terminus. All right, so somatic nervous system, one neuron to the effector organ. Let's compare and contrast this now with the autonomic nervous system. Here is central nervous system, right, of the autonomic nervous system. Here we see the cell bodies and dendrites within the CNS. These axons leave the CNS and go into, where do they go into? Peripheral nervous system. All right, but they don't go all the way to the effector organ, which would be what? Smooth muscle, glands, and cardiac muscle. They stop before they get there. Here's an axon terminus. And then here is a second neuron, which takes that information the rest of the way to the effector organ. So how many neurons do you see from CNS to effector organ? Yeah, you see two, back to back or in series. Right, here is a junction that has a synapse. And what kind of synapse does this look like? Electrical or chemical? That's a nice chemical synapse. And this one right here uses acetylcholine, just like the neuromuscular junction. And as a matter of fact, receptor types are exactly the same, which is sort of interesting. And what do we call a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the central nervous system? A group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the central nervous system. Yeah, gray matter. Right, it is gray matter, and we want to call it a nucleus, right? A nucleus, or an older terminology that would, some people call it a ganglion, like the basal ganglia, but that's really bad nomenclature, because where do you know ganglia exists now, for sure, with modern nomenclature? In the peripheral nervous system, same thing, nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the peripheral nervous system, and so I see nerve cell and dendrites right here, nerve cell body and dendrites, so this thing is going to be gray matter in the peripheral nervous system, which is what we call a ganglion, right? And we've got a number of these ganglion before these autonomic signals get to their effector organs. And since they're two neurons, the first one we call the preganglionic neuron, the second one we call the postganglionic neuron. So instead of the presynaptic and postsynaptic, since we're talking about autonomic nervous system, one is the pre and the other is the postganglionic neuron. All right, the preganglionic neuron releases acetylcholine, but now let's look at that postganglionic neuron. When a nerve impulse comes down, what kind of neurotransmitter is released? Is it acetylcholine? It is not. It is norepinephrine. Sometimes we call this noradrenaline. Another molecule that's very similar to norepinephrine is epinephrine, and another name for epinephrine is adrenaline. So you're kind of familiar with these things already. All right, so adrenaline, noradrenaline, or epinephrine and norepinephrine. All right, so that's an important distinction. Somatic nervous system, one neuron. Autonomic nervous system are always two in series, and there's a ganglion in between with one exception. We're going to look at one exception of what that is. All right, so this is sympathetic outflow. All right, and norepinephrine can be excitatory or it can be inhibitory depending on what organ it is. Different organs will have different kinds of receptors, will respond differently even though the signaling molecule is the same. That's how we explain that. And it's clinically, that's hugely important to know these things. And in physiology, you get to appreciate some of that stuff, but not so much in anatomy. All right, so that is this first row within the sympathetic. Let's go down to the parasympathetic nervous system. How many neurons does it take to get from central nervous system to effector organ? Yeah, and the effector organs are going to be heart, glands, smooth muscle, right? And again, it's two. And what's in between the central nervous system and the effector organ? There is a ganglion, which has a nice chemical synapse. The neurotransmitter in this ganglion is acetylcholine, just like in the sympathetic nervous system, just like the neuromuscular junction, right? And the receptor types are exactly the same. Okay. But for the parasympathetic nervous system, now the postganglionic fiber releases a signaling compound. Is it the same as the sympathetic nervous system?
No.
Or is it different? It's not the same. That's right. What is the neurotransmitter for the postganglionic neuron? Postganglionic neuron is what? First one or second one? Second one. And for parasympathetic outflow, what's the neurotransmitter for the postganglionic neuron? Where would we find that? It is acetylcholine. So what's the difference between sympathetic and parasympathetic in terms of the postganglionic neuron? Sympathetic releases norepinephrine and parasympathetic releases acetylcholine. Right. In most cases. Maybe not 100% of the time, but I think this is good for you just to kind of memorize that. I've got to cover that mic up. Where is it? Right here. Okay. Some structural differences between the preganglionic and postganglionic neurons and between sympathetic and parasympathetic. What can you tell me about this preganglionic fiber? Is it fast or slow?
Slow.
Oh, I hear slow and fast. I'm confused. Okay. Well, what are we going to look for? Myelination. Do you see myelination?
No.
Indeed, I do. I see a Schwann cell right here. I see another Schwann cell right here. So it is myelinated. These preganglionic fibers do have myelinated axons. It is fast. What about the postganglionic fiber? Fast or slow? Yeah, because it's not myelinated. What about for the parasympathetic nervous system? The preganglionic parasympathetic is
fast.
The postganglionic parasympathetic is slow. All right, so they're similar in that respect. Okay. One other thing I want to point out to you, what about the length of the preganglionic fiber in the sympathetic nervous system? Is it long or short? But before you answer that, let's look at the preganglionic axon for the parasympathetic nervous system. I'm going to ask you, is it relatively long or short? All right, so I'm just talking about in a relative sense. Relative sense. Sympathetic is what? Relatively short or long? It's relatively short. The preganglionic and parasympathetic is relatively long. This is true. The reason why is because these ganglia in the sympathetic nervous system are very close to the spinal cord or vertebral column. So a nerve leaves the spinal cord, only has to travel a short distance to where that ganglion is, as opposed to these ganglia for the parasympathetic nervous system are right on the surface of the effector organ or even inside the effector organ. So, for instance, on the heart, this preganglionic fiber has to go all the way to the heart, right to the surface of the heart, way far away from the spinal cord, and so the preganglionic fiber has to be long, which then also means that for parasympathetic, the postganglionic fiber is really short because the ganglion is right there by that effector organ. But what about the postganglionic fiber for the sympathetic nervous system? Since this ganglion is close to the spinal cord, then the postganglionic fiber has to be long to get to that effector organ. So there are some differences, anatomical differences. All right, so this is a particularly good slide. You have something that's similar in your study guide, maybe a little bit different because some of the previous editions, I like the figures a little bit better. And I think that you should be able to label those figures, even though they're a little bit different. Right? It will stretch your mind a little bit. If you have a question, then maybe see me office hours or in lecture to label those pictures of the autonomic nervous system. Okay, so I said that somatic is, just takes one neuron to get effector organ. Autonomic nervous system takes two, in most cases with one really important exception to that rule. We didn't talk about it, and that is in the second row of the sympathetic nervous system. I see a nice preganglionic fiber that is myelinated, so it's relatively fast. And where does this preganglionic fiber go? Do you see it going to a ganglion? It passes through all the ganglia, and it goes to the adrenal medulla directly. Okay, and what part of the adrenal gland is the medulla? Is it the superficial part or the deep part? It's the deep part. Remember, medulla is the deep part of any organ. So the axon terminus is deep inside the adrenal medulla, and it's going to, the preganglionic fiber releases acetylcholine as a neurotransmitter. When it binds the receptors of the cells in the adrenal medulla, the cells of the adrenal medulla then immediately release epinephrine, or adrenaline, right, and some norepinephrine into the extracellular space, and then that epinephrine and norepinephrine get absorbed by the blood. They enter the blood via a capillary that's in the adrenal medulla, and once it's in the blood, where does it go then? Everywhere that blood goes, which is most places in your body, right, except for epithelium and maybe some types of connective tissue, like dense regular connective tissue. Right, so any vascularized part of your body then receives epinephrine and norepinephrine. And what are these things? These are the signals for what kind of stimulation? Sympathetic stimulation. So so here is an example where sympathetic outflow to the adrenal gland only has the preganglionic fiber, and the cells of the adrenal medulla are then acting like what? They're acting like the postganglionic fiber, except not do they only release norepinephrine, they also release some epinephrine. Epinephrine lasts longer in your blood than norepinephrine, so it's a longer lasting kind of sympathetic signal that goes everywhere in your body. Okay. One of the next chapters that we're going to study is called the endocrine system, and an endocrine gland is, well, I guess we kind of learned the definition maybe once upon a time. We learned about glands. One has ducts, the other doesn't have ducts. What did we call one that has a duct? That is an exocrine gland, right? What kind of gland does not have ducts? An endocrine gland. Because an endocrine gland secretes a product, and the blood then becomes basically a duct that's carrying it everywhere in the body. All right, so the adrenal medulla is sort of acting like an endocrine gland, right? And it's sort of acting like the postganglionic neuron. And the adrenal medulla releases epinephrine, norepinephrine that enter the circulatory system. So epinephrine and norepinephrine really are not acting like a neurotransmitter. They're acting more like a hormone. And that's something that we're going to learn in one of the upcoming chapters. All right, so what would you like to call epinephrine and norepinephrine in this circumstance? Would you like to call them a hormone or a neurotransmitter? Okay, you know, but they're being released by something that looks like the postganglionic neuron. So they're kind of like neurotransmitter as well. All right, so there's some confusion right here, and the proper term would be a neurohormone. All right, so they have characteristics of both. So this is an important interface between what two major systems in your body that control your body. One would be the nervous system, and the other would be the endocrine system, right? And there are a few places in your body where that interface is very important for controlling important functions in your body. As a matter of fact, they're so important that in a lot of classes, some classes that you might take, the nervous system is not separated from the endocrine system as they are in our class. They're combined in one chapter, and then that chapter would be called the neuroendocrine chapter, or neuroendocrine system, because they function together. Here's just one point where they do, okay, which is kind of an exception of the usual kind of outflow pathway for autonomic stimulation. All right, now who's got a question on this? I'm sure you're going to have to study this and think of this. Maybe you can't even come up with a question right now, okay? There's a lot of detail just on this particular slide, but where do you want to start? How many neurons does it take for a somatic outflow pathway? Just one. How many neurons for an autonomic outflow pathway? two. And so you should know which the preganglionic, postganglionic, what kind of neurotransmitters they secrete, which is myelinated, which is not myelinated, which ones are short, which ones are long, right? And what a ganglion is, and where do we find ganglia, right? The ganglia from the parasympathetic nervous system on the surface of an organ or inside the organ sometimes is called a terminal ganglion, a terminal ganglion. Ganglia in the sympathetic nervous system are called paravertebral or prevertebral. Para just means on either side of the vertebral column. Prevertebral means in front of, anterior to the vertebral column. All right, so if you hear para or prevertebral, you know it's sympathetic. If you hear terminal ganglia, you also know that it is parasympathetic. Okay. That's a really important slide. And I've lost track of the word slide over here. Well, let's see. What did we talk about? Comparative neuroanatomy of the somatic versus the autonomic nervous system. Yeah, I think we talked about all this stuff. But let's read a couple of these questions to see if indeed I did talk about it. What is the effector in the somatic or voluntary pathway? What's the effector for somatic pathway? It's going to be skeletal muscle, right? That's voluntary. What are the effectors in the autonomic or visceral motor pathway? Cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, glands. Yep, just like that. Really nice and simple. Okay. Control system architecture. We talked about antagonistic control. Give me an example in your car. Why it is a good example to have a sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system in terms of your car. What are two things in your car that are antagonistic to each other, but you would never think of driving your car without these two things? Yeah, gas pedal and brake, right? If you only had a gas pedal, that could be fantastic. You could get home, but when you got home, what would happen? You just have to wave goodbye because you couldn't stop, right? Okay. Same thing for all these other things in your body, right? We don't want to stimulate the heart because once we stimulate it, it might start beating very, very fast, and then it would never slow down again without the other autonomic nervous system, right? So that's really important. All right, well, what are some of the, do you think it would be a good idea to have tonic or antagonistic? Tonic just means one nerve, like going to skeletal muscle. Do you think it would be a good idea to have tonic or antagonistic control over important body functions, such as heart rate? Tonic, one nerve or two nerves? Yeah, sure, for antagonistic. Skeletal muscle, okay, sort of has that built in already, right? It only has one nerve, one kind of nervous system going to its somatic, but what can you tell me about the muscular system? You have muscles that are antagonistic to each other, like the biceps and triceps. So it doesn't really need antagonistic nervous system because the muscles are arranged in that fashion automatically. All right, so let's think about these two divisions in terms of the functions that they produce in the body. Your book has a whole big, long list of functions, but I want you to know at least these four right here. All right, so I'm going to ask you to know four of them. You can't always say that one division of the autonomic nervous system, like parasympathetic nervous system, is inhibitory because sometimes it is excitatory. So here in this example, right, parasympathetic nervous system slows down the heart rate, so it inhibits the heart, but it increases digestive function. So it's excitatory on the digestive system. So you can't always say parasympathetic inhibits or excites. The only thing that you can say with almost 100% certainty is if the parasympathetic nervous system inhibits the heart, what can you say about the sympathetic nervous system? It is excitatory on the heart, right? They're going to be antagonistic to each other. So if you know how one functions, then you pretty much know what the other one does automatically because of that principle of antagonism. All right. So cell bodies. We're going to talk about that in just a little bit. I got some slides of this. I want to talk about this. We talked about ganglia, right? Ganglia for parasympathetic are near or in the target organ. Right, they're called terminal ganglia. And let's consider these four targets. What's the effect of parasympathetic nervous system? Decreased heart rate, decreased respiration, pupil constriction. So what happens to your pupil when it constricts? It gets really, really small. And what is the result of that? More light enter or less light enter? less light enters. That's right. Okay, and digestion, the parasympathetic nervous system enhances digestion, enhances motility, contraction, enhances the secretion of digestive enzymes. Right, so parasympathetic is not always inhibitory or making some things smaller. So one way that we can characterize the parasympathetic nervous system is the rest and digest part of the autonomic nervous system. Go ahead, write that down. Rest and digest. Because digest, because it excites digestive processes, but what about the heart? When your heart rate slows down, are you in excited or rested state?
Rest.
Yeah, rested state. Okay. And when you're in a rested state, are you hyperventilating or are you just breathing very quietly? Quietly, right? Okay. And when you're in a rested state, you don't need a lot of information coming in your eyes because you're not concerned about anything, right? So your pupils are constricted unless it's really, really bright outside. Okay, so this is the rest and digest nervous system. What are some other things we talked about? Preganglionic neurotransmitter is acetylcholine. Postganglionic is also acetylcholine. Oh, that should be a capital C right there. Can I change that right now? Maybe. I don't know. Change that in your notes. Ooh, I should probably save it once again. Okay. All right. So rest and digest nervous system. The reason why, okay, for instance, like right after a meal, your digestive system should be stimulated to do its job, but blood flow doesn't necessarily need to go to skeletal muscle and to your lungs. Okay, because under those conditions, you should not be exercising. Because what did your mother always tell you when you were growing up? What about a pool? If somebody said you could go swimming when you were a kid, what did you do? Even if it was snowing outside, what would you do? You would go swimming, right? Little kids just don't, they want to go swimming no matter what, like you. Okay, so what did your mom tell you about going swimming right after lunch? No. You had to wait, okay? And maybe it was a big mystery to you, but now, what can you tell me? You can tell me, like, right after lunch, you have a bunch of blood going to the digestive tract for digesting all that food that you've just eaten. You don't have enough blood in your body to go everywhere at one time. Your body has to pick where that blood goes, right? Whenever you start to exercise the skeletal muscle, then that's going to be a very powerful signal to allow blood to go to skeletal muscle. And then what happens to that blood that should be going to the digestive tract? It's going to be less, right? And so your digestive tract, there's smooth muscles in there, will be hurting for oxygen, and it might cause them to go into a tonic contracture, or what we call a spasm or a cramp or something like that. And maybe even stomach muscles. Right, and what happens if you get a big, powerful cramp in your abdominal compartment when you're swimming? It might be so bad you might not be able to hold your head above water. Right, and what happens then? You start breathing water instead of air. Right, so that's the deal with that. Not enough blood to go everywhere. Right, so parasympathetic is excitatory on the digestive tract. We talked about all this stuff already. What about sympathetic nervous system? Well, ganglia are far away from the target organ. They're close to the vertebral column one way or another. The ganglia could be the paravertebral on either side, or they could be the prevertebral right in front of the vertebral column. Sometimes the paravertebral are called the sympathetic chain ganglia, and sometimes the prevertebral are called collateral ganglia. So sometimes, as you know in anatomy, a thing can have a number of different names. I'm going to show you some pictures of where this stuff is in just a little bit. All right, but what is the effect of sympathetic stimulation on these four target tissues? Right, the heart, digestive system, respiratory system, and pupils. It's going to be exactly opposite compared to the parasympathetic nervous system. So, sympathetic, what's the effect of sympathetic stimulation on the heart? Increases. Right? It's excitatory. What about digestion? Inhibitory. Respiration increases. And pupil, what's the effect on the pupil? Dilation. All right, so this might seem a little mysterious at the moment until we're a little bit familiar with These two ways to think about these autonomic divisions. What did we say, what's a good way to characterize parasympathetic as the something and something else? Rest and digest nervous system, okay? Sympathetic, on the other hand, is not rest and digest, it is fight or flight nervous system. Right, so this nervous system becomes activated when you're presented with a life-threatening stimulus, right, or any kind of threatening stimulus. It doesn't have to be life-threatening, but if it is, then it even stimulates the sympathetic nervous system even more. Okay, so let's just say today you were driving down the 405 freeway to get to school, and there was a big semi-tractor trailer in the lane next to you on the left, and there happened to be one next to you on the right. And you're going to pass between them right in the middle, and all of a sudden the one on the right decides to get into the same lane you're in because they don't see you. And there you're sandwiched in between these two big trucks, and one is ready to crush you into the other one. And sometimes you might think, well, you know what, there's nothing I can do. For sure I'm going to die when that happens, right? Like we've probably all been in the circumstance similar to that. So what happens to your heart rate in those circumstances? You sure you're going to get crushed by these big trucks? What happens to your heart rate? It increases, right? You can feel your heart inside your chest beating very, very rapidly. Okay, what about your respiratory system? I skipped digestion. What about your respiratory system? What happens? When you see this, you go like that, and you start to hyperventilate, right? Because what is necessary? Your heart needs all that oxygen. Your brain needs all that oxygen. And skeletal muscles need oxygen. Say you're going to try and do something to get out of that circumstance. Right, and what about your pupil dilation or pupil constriction or dilation? What happens when you're for sure you think you're going to die? Should your pupils constrict so you don't see very much, or they're going to dilate, right? They're going to get big so you can take in all of that information so that you can somehow deal with that stressful situation, right? So a very easy and powerful way to think of the differences between parasympathetic and sympathetic is rest and digest versus fight or flight. And when you have a lot of blood going to your heart, your lungs, okay, your brain, then we can't have blood going to the digestive tract because there's just not enough. So that's why sympathetic nervous system inhibits digestion, because you don't really need to be digesting when you need to be using skeletal muscles, right, to deal with that threatening situation. So that's important to know. And as a matter of fact, you'll recognize that in even commercials. There was a commercial one time, I think it was a BMW commercial, and it showed somebody's eyes. It showed somebody's heart. They didn't show digestive tract, but that would have been cool. Okay? They showed somebody's eyes. They showed somebody's lungs, and they showed somebody's heart. All right? And this BMW car drove down a road, and what did that person's heart do? BMW commercial didn't show the heart slowing down. Heart rate increased. What about the iris? Whoa, dilated, right? Sympathetic stimulation, right? And what about breathing? Increased, right? So people are kind of familiar with these things, and this is just a nice subliminal message that whoever designed that commercial used some physiology. And I'm sure everybody that produces a movie employs a physiologist, right? Not only to show these things in the movie, but when they develop some kind of technique, whether it's a visual technique or auditory technique, they measure people to see what nervous system is being stimulated. So when you go see a movie and you pay, I don't know, how much does it cost to see a movie? Well, if you got to pay for parking, I don't know, $40, $50, something like that. Would you pay $40 or $50 to go see a movie that stimulates your parasympathetic nervous system? Slow your heart down. Make you fall asleep, get into a digestive episode. No, you wouldn't. What kind of nervous system do you want to be activated when you pay $45 to go see? Yeah, something that stimulates in a very significant way your sympathetic nervous system, right? Okay. All right, so it's important to know this kind of stuff. All right, so rest and digest versus fight or flight. So make sure you can answer some of these questions. Pre- and postganglionic fibers of the parasympathetic nervous system, cholinergic or adrenergic? Ooh, I'm glad I read this because I didn't tell you. A cholinergic nerve is a nerve that releases acetylcholine. An adrenergic nerve releases norepinephrine. Right? So adrenergic comes from adrenaline, would be one way to help you memorize that. So what about the pre and post of the parasympathetic? Are they cholinergic or adrenergic? So where we look? Autonomic nervous system, parasympathetic, the preganglionic, right, is in the question, and the postganglionic. Are these neurons cholinergic or adrenergic? Both of them. They are? They are cholinergic because they release acetylcholine. So that's how I would answer that question. What about the next one? How would you describe the difference between the pre- and postganglionic neurons of the parasympathetic? Oh, okay, so we're still talking about parasympathetic. What's the difference between these two? They're both cholinergic, but is there a difference between them? Yeah, one is short, one is long. Which is the short one? The postganglionic fiber. One is myelinated, one's not myelinated. Which one's myelinated? The preganglionic fiber. Okay, so this is anatomy. Definitely got to know these things. Okay, probably got a question for sympathetic nervous system. How would you describe the difference between the pre- and postganglionic neurons of the sympathetic nervous system? Okay, which one is longer? Oh, here, sympathetic. Ah, sympathetic. Right here, sympathetic outflow. Which one is longer? The postganglionic fiber. Which one is myelinated? The pre. So there are some similarities, but some differences between the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system. What's another difference between the pre- and postganglionic fiber in a sympathetic outflow pathway? Okay, but we said that already. The difference is one is myelinated one, and the post is not myelinated. But there's another important difference. What do you see? What else do you see here? Yeah, the neurotransmitter is different, right? Which one releases acetylcholine? The preganglionic fiber. Which one releases something different? And we see it's norepinephrine. That is the postganglionic fiber. Okay. All right. So those are really important things for you to know. Okay. Let's look at some more slides, and I can fill in some more concepts right here. Okay. So this slide right here, a little bit small, and maybe I'll zoom into this one. And maybe you could tell me what color this is. What color is this thing right here? Blue, purple, I don't know what it is. Blue, right? Blue. Yeah? You can live with blue? Okay. These blue nerves right here represent outflow pathways of the parasympathetic nervous system only, not sympathetic. All right. And how do these parasympathetic nerves leave the central nervous system in terms of location? Is it anywhere in the spinal cord, and is it everywhere, every cranial nerve? Only a selective few, right? Parasympathetic outflow, right, is what we say is craniosacral. It leaves through a couple cranial nerves and just a few sacral nerves, S2 through S4. Cranial nerves, right, 3, 7, 9, and 10. And in particular, 10 is the most important. You can see it going to most of the effector organs in your body. Anybody remember the name of cranial nerve number 10? On Olympus and Tower and Top of the German, viewed a hop, right? Vagus nerve, right? And indeed, you're going to live with that one for the rest of your life, right? Cranial nerve number 10, vagus nerve, most important nerve for parasympathetic outflow, right? So it goes to glands, salivary glands, heart, lungs, liver, digestive tract, all right, or at least the upper divisions of the digestive tract. The reproductive organs and lower divisions of the digestive tract originate from the sacral nerves, but cranial nerve number 10 probably the most important. All right, so that blue is the preganglionic fiber. The light blue, right, is that a light blue right there? That is the postganglionic fiber. And you can see how short it is compared to the preganglionic fiber. And the preganglionic fiber is dark probably because it is myelinated. The postganglionic fiber is light, and maybe it's even a dashed line. I'm not really sure. Can't quite see well enough. Is short, and it's not myelinated. So this diagram shows you that. But I think the important take-home message is, oh, here's a little key. Here's a little key down here for color. But it doesn't say blue or light blue. It should do that. It's very insensitive of them not to have that there. Okay, what was the take-home message? Take-home message is, parasympathetic outflow is what in terms of your anatomy? The outflow is craniosacral, right? So the cranium is nowhere near the sacrum, but we can combine those two terms, cranium and sacrum, with what we have to put between those two words, an O. But for the parasympathetic nervous system, that makes perfect sense because that's the only way parasympathetic outflow can leave the central nervous system is what? Craniosacral. So even though they're really far apart, that's just the way our nervous system has developed. So this is parasympathetic. What about sympathetic? Oh, this is nice. I see cranial nerve number 10. Here is the postganglionic fiber. Here is, what is this junction right here called between the pre- and postganglionic fiber right on the surface of the heart? That's a ganglion. There's a synapse there. Yeah, there's a synapse there, but it's a ganglion. But what I was asking, what's the name of that, general name of this ganglion? What's the general name of this ganglion here? Remember, because a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites is a ganglion, this is what we call a terminal ganglion. Terminal ganglion, because it's so close to the effector organ. Okay. All right, so this is parasympathetic. Maybe I passed through sympathetic already. No, let me find it. Sympathetic outflow. Oh, we got to have it someplace. Where is sympathetic? This will be pathetic if I don't have sympathetic. Aha! Here it is right here. Okay. So, what can you tell me about the outflow pathways for sympathetic stimulation? Is it craniosacral? It is not. It is what we call thoracolumbar. Thoracolumbar. That's the only way sympathetic signals can leave the central nervous system through T1 through L2, hence all right, those spinal nerves, hence we call that the thoracolumbar nervous system, sympathetic. Okay, and then here's the preganglionic fiber. It goes into the sympathetic chain ganglia where there are some synapses like some of these other ganglia. And it's a chain of them with connections between all of the ganglia. There is a right one and a left one. And this sort of reminds me as an auxiliary spinal cord. It's not in the vertebral column, but it's on either side of the vertebral column. It's like an auxiliary spinal cord for what kind of information? Sympathetic or parasympathetic? Sympathetic. So these are like auxiliary spinal cords for sympathetic outflow. And since they're on either side of the vertebral column, we call these the paravertebral, either the sympathetic chain ganglia or the paravertebral ganglia. Okay. We also said, though, that some preganglionic fibers pass right through the sympathetic chain ganglia and go to ganglia that are in front of the vertebral column. So these right here represents the prevertebral ganglia, or sometimes we call these collateral ganglia. Okay, but nonetheless, how many neurons does it take to get from central nervous system to effector organ?
Two.
Yeah, preganglionic and postganglionic. Again, dark color, light color. Dark color represents preganglionic, but also myelinated, right? And the postganglionic light because they're not myelinated. Now, which ones are longer, the preganglionic or postganglionic for sympathetic? The posts are longer, which is what you can see because these ganglia are very close to the vertebral column, not the effector organs. And go ahead, while I'm looking at the slide, tell me, what are the effector organs once again?
Glands.
Yeah, I like that. Smooth muscle, I like that. And cardiac muscle. Great. Okay. That's pretty good. Okay, now there is one exception to that rule. What was the one exception of needing a pre- and postganglionic fiber to get to a sympathetic effector organ? The adrenal medulla. Can we see an adrenal medulla here? Wow, you haven't looked at it yet in anatomy because we're just almost halfway done, but we haven't looked at it yet.
Right.
Here's the kidney. On top of the kidney is the adrenal gland. All right, and what can you tell me about the color of this neuron right here? Is it dark or is it light?
Yeah.
It's dark. So there is a preganglionic fiber that leaves thoracolumbar division, goes passes right through the sympathetic chain, even passes through a prevertebral ganglia or collateral ganglia, and it goes all the way to the adrenal medulla. Preganglionic fiber goes all the way. And it's these cells of the adrenal medulla that will act like the postganglionic fiber. And when they receive acetylcholine from this preganglionic fiber, what do those cells of the adrenal medulla do? They release sympathetic signaling compounds into the blood. And probably you should be able to tell me the name of those sympathetic signaling compounds. They would be neuroendocrines, namely epinephrine and norepinephrine. That's the job of these cells. And you might have to know the name of those cells. Those are called chromaffin cells because of the way they stain when somebody looked at them underneath the microscope. Chromaffin cells release norepinephrine and epinephrine directly into the blood. Okay, so I want to look at some more details. How did these preganglionic fibers get into the sympathetic chain? And then, furthermore, how do they get to their effector organs? There's some more important information there. And I'm not going to flip around, so I'm going to look over here. Maybe I'll start looking here. All right, so where do I have the cursor right now? What's running right down through here? The vertebral column. All right. And on either side of the vertebral column, you see like a string of pearls right here and right here. That's what we call the sympathetic chain. And these bulges right here are, where have you seen a bulge like this in the peripheral nervous system before? How about in the dorsal root? Did you ever see a thing there in the dorsal root? What did we call that thing? Dorsal root ganglion. Here is sympathetic chain ganglion. Right? Nerve cell bodies for the postganglionic fibers. All right, so spinal nerves leave the spinal cord, enter the sympathetic chain. Sometimes they pass through the sympathetic chain and go to these ganglia that are anterior to the vertebral column. All right, so we don't want to call these sympathetic chain ganglia or paravertebral ganglia. We want to call these prevertebral or collateral ganglia, okay, where there is a synapse to the postganglionic fiber. So these are like auxiliary spinal cords, right, for what kind of outflow? Somatic outflow, sympathetic or parasympathetic? These chain ganglia, sympathetic outflow, yeah. Not parasympathetic, not somatic, but only sympathetic outflow. Okay. So we need to look at some details. So what do we got right here? What are we looking at? Here's a nice vertebral body, right? Here is spinal cord. I can see some gray matter, some white matter, right? And how does a sympathetic impulse leave the spinal cord? Dorsal root or ventral root? Yeah, it's got to be ventral, right? Because ventral is motor. When it's leaving, it's got to be motor. If it's entering, then it is sensory or afferent. All right, so sympathetic outflow leaves the ventral root, and it goes into this junction right here, the junction where the dorsal root and ventral root come together. What do we call this thing? Here's a root, and here's a root. So these are the roots, right? They're either motor or sensory, but what about this thing here? This is the spinal nerve. And it's mixed, right? It's mixed. So we have a sympathetic outflow, and then it can either move into this nerve or into this nerve. And this is a review. What did we call this and this? Okay. I'll give you half of what it is. This is a ramus. Which ramus is this where I have the cursor? Ventral ramus, and this is the dorsal ramus. And which one is bigger, the dorsal or the ventral ramus?
Ventral,
because most of your body is anterior to the vertebral column. The dorsal ramus is a lot smaller because you just have a few muscles back there, some skin, and that's about it. Okay, now what does this thing look like? Sympathetic chain for sympathetic outflow, right? And here's a sympathetic chain ganglia for the junction between the pre and post ganglionic fibers. So how did these signals get in there? They leave the ventral root, they get into the spinal nerve, and in particular they end up in the ventral ramus, and then they move into the sympathetic chain. Now which one do they go through? The white ramus communicantes or the gray ramus communicans. Sometimes it's called a communicans, sometimes it's called a communicantes here, it's called a communicans. The white or the gray? Okay, white. I like white. Because, what about that preganglionic fiber? Is it myelinated or not myelinated? It is myelinated, right? So here this communicans is myelinated, so that's why we got to call that the white one. And then if it synapses and stimulates a postganglionic fiber, right, it's going to leave the sympathetic chain, go back into the spinal nerve, and go to whatever organ, right, that it should be going to via this nerve right here. And what can you tell me about the postganglionic fiber? Myelinated or not myelinated? Not myelinated. So here is the gray ramus communicans. So it's kind of a funny loop these things have to take. Physiology book actually has that wrong. Okay, so sometimes there's a synapse in this ganglia. Sometimes that sympathetic nerve leaves the spinal cord via the ventral root into the spinal nerve, into the white ramus, into the sympathetic chain, and it passes right through to a prevertebral ganglia, where it meets up with the postganglionic fiber. So let's see. I think we talked about everything in here. You know all of these structures from before. Now you know some of these rami and rami communicans as well. All right. So here we see a body of a sympathetic motor neuron. And of course the cell body is going to be in the gray matter of the spinal cord. And cell bodies of interneurons are here in the dorsal horn, motor neurons are in the ventral horn, but sympathetic neurons are in what we call the lateral horn. So we see these lateral horns only in certain parts of the spinal cord. Can you think of what parts of the spinal cord have lateral horns? Yeah, thoracolumbar division, right? Because that's the only way that sympathetic nerves leave. All right, so this nerve, the axon leaves, the ventral root goes into the spinal nerve, which is back over here, enters the white ramus, and in this particular case, it's going to stop right there, release a neurotransmitter on a cell body of the postganglionic fiber, which then goes through the gray ramus, because what, that axon is not myelinated, into that spinal nerve, which is going to take it to where it should go, like maybe to the skin, for instance. What's the neurotransmitter that's being used right here between the pre- and postganglionic fiber? Okay. Well, that's the it's a chemical synapse, and the neurotransmitter is always going to be acetylcholine, no matter if it's sympathetic or parasympathetic, right? So acetylcholine stimulates nerve impulses in that postganglionic fiber. It goes to skin, maybe even some blood vessels right here. When that nerve impulse reaches the end of this axon, what is the end of this axon going to release? What neurotransmitter is going to be released by the postganglionic fiber? Norepinephrine, right? Because the preganglionic fiber is cholinergic. The postganglionic fiber is adrenergic. So these are all the ways that we talk about these things. Might anybody listen to this lecture again online? Nobody? Nobody will. I suggest that you do. But I got a couple more comments. I only got 1201. All right, so this is one scheme. But there are other schemes that can be used for sympathetic outflow, and this is the reason for the sympathetic chain. It's a special kind of plexus. All right, so here we have a nerve cell body in the lateral horn. The axon leaves the ventral root into the spinal nerve, right, gets into the ventral ramus and through the white ramus communicans into the sympathetic chain, but now do you see it synapsing right here in this ganglia? You do not. This one arises one division. All right, so there can be bifurcations of this preganglionic fiber, and sometimes it goes up the sympathetic chain, sometimes it can even go up and down to different levels before it synapses. So in this particular case, it went up one division where it synapses, and now the postganglionic fiber leads the gray ramus into the spinal nerve to its effector organ. One last thing. Okay. Here we have that sympathetic nerve fiber leaving the ventral root, getting into the spinal nerve, entering the sympathetic chain through, what is this thing right here? White ramus communicans into the sympathetic chain, and now here, it doesn't go up, it doesn't go down. What does it do? It passes straight through. So this is still the preganglionic nerve fiber, but how many neurons does it take for an autonomic outflow pathway? One or two? There's got to be two. I just see the first one. So there's got to be a second one someplace with a synapse, right, with a ganglion in between the two, and here it is. It's not in the sympathetic chain. It's in front of the vertebral column, so this is what we call the prevertebral ganglion, and here is the postganglionic fiber going to the effector organ. Okay, so sometimes they synapse in the sympathetic chain, sometimes they pass through to get to a prevertebral. This nerve that carries, right, the preganglionic axons, this is a nerve passing through the sympathetic chain into the prevertebral ganglion. These are always going to be called a splanchnic nerve. So that is probably something, I don't know, I lived for decades without really knowing where a splanchnic nerve was, right? And so don't forget, a splanchnic nerve is just something that connects the sympathetic chain to these prevertebral ganglia, and it's carrying sympathetic impulses down through these sympathetic axons of what? A preganglionic fiber. And there are a number of different kinds of splanchnic nerves, but I just want you to know all of them as a splanchnic nerve. It's a splanchnic nerve if the preganglionic fiber passes right through the sympathetic chain. Okay, then that's going to be a splanchnic nerve. And what did we say this kind of ganglion was? We call it a prevertebral. What's another name for prevertebral ganglia? Collateral ganglion, right? And why do we call this a ganglion? Because it's nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the peripheral nervous system. What do we call a bunch of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the central nervous system? Yeah, it's gray matter, but what's the name of that gray matter? It's called a nucleus. It's called a nucleus. So a nucleus is in the CNS, ganglion is in the PNS. Unless you're really old, then you might call the basal nuclei basal ganglia, but you should really change your terminology because the basal ganglia really are basal nuclei in modern nomenclature because they're in the central nervous system. Okay, make sure you sign the sign-in sheet, and I'll see you guys on Monday. That's too bad. You can sign it, but there's not enough time to sign it. Okay? Okay, so everybody's absent today. Ooh, better not miss another class.